Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 338, Tuesday, May 28th, 2019.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, KMO here, and what I have for you is this past weekend's radio show. Normally this would go out on the main Sea Realm podcast, but I owe you Vault subscribers an episode, so you guys come first. So here is my most recent conversation with Dermot O'Connor, the angry animator.
Everything from nuanced talk to just plain fun and our own hometown DJs. Mostly music from around the middle of the day to the middle of the night, mostly talk the rest of the time, and weekends are a grab bag. This is Black Sheep Radio, WOOL-FM, 91.5, Billows Falls, community radio for the southern Vermont and New Hampshire borderlands.
You're listening to WOOL Black Sheep Radio on 91.5 FM, Sea Realm Radio with KMO.
Hello, Billows Falls. KMO here on a beautiful day. Oh my goodness, it couldn't be much better. What a great day to spend sitting in front of a computer. No. Go outside. Hopefully I have Dermot O'Connor, the angry animator, on the line. Dermot, are you there?
I'm here.
Yay! So Dermot, we can talk about whatever you want in just a minute, but first there are a couple pieces of information that I need to share with the local terrestrial radio audience. First up, Jewish mysticism's teachings of the Kabbalah. This will be Thursday, June 6th at 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Brattleboro Museum and Art Center at 10 Vernon Street in Brattleboro. What are the physics and metaphysics of the universe? What is the role of humans in creation? Dermot, what is the role of humans in creation?
Well, I wish I was there. I'd definitely go to see that. I've been doing a lot of reading on Renaissance magic and all that kind of stuff, so that would be interesting to me anyway.
Go ahead.
Fascinating subject. Yeah, no, I've just been reading a book called, it's an old book from the 1960s. It's called Francis Yates wrote it. It's called Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Tradition. And basically it overturned like a lot of bad 19th century historical ideas about the Renaissance and how basically it showed just how much of it was based on Hermetic magic and Kabbalah, stuff like that.
Let me stop you there. let me get these PSAs out of the way, and then we will delve into that. That sounds great.
Go ahead.
So this Jewish mysticism course, or it's not a course, it's a one-time event. It will be taught by Rabbi Andrea Cohen Keener. I'm guessing that's her last name, K-I-E-N-E-R. She'll share basic and universal ideas from the Jewish tradition, which parallel other world traditions and challenge us to participate meaningfully in planetary development. Big aims there. Rabbi Cohen Keener will share fundamental ideas from Jewish mysticism, especially the Kabbalistic teachings on cosmology and how the world came into being. Again, that's going to be in Brattleboro this coming Thursday or the Thursday after next? It's Thursday, June 6th. So if you have a calendar, you're better oriented than I am. Graffiti, 200 years of history at the Dodge Tavern. So this is coming up June 7th, so the day after the Kabbalistic teachings seminar. You could go learn about Kabbalah and then come back up here to Walpole and learn about graffiti. The Walpole Historical Society is hosting a presentation by local archaeologist Gail Golick entitled Graffiti, 200 Years of History at the Dodge Tavern on June 7th, 2019 at 7 p.m. at the Walpole Town Hall. The old Dodge Tavern has been the cornerstone of a small enclave in the northeast corner of town known as the Valley for over 200 years. Golick's presentation will give a comprehensive history of the Valley and serve as the backdrop for the WHS Summer Exhibit, The Valley, opening that weekend, entitled Life in the Valley, the history of a little-known Walpole community told through the McNutt and Thompson families circa 1919. The presentation will be 80 minutes long with an intermission and will consist of a narrated slideshow created by Golic for her local history podcast, The Secret Life of Death. The event is free of charge and open to all. There will be refreshments available. So, interesting content, local celebrity, free food, free admission. What's not to like? There are more announcements that you can find on our website. It is blacksheepradio.org. Look for the Mid-River Bulletin Board. All right. Dermot O'Connor. You know, one thing I miss about living in New York City was the graffiti. There's some amazing graffiti to be found in New York City.
There's a lot of formal street art and graffiti here as well, yeah.
So you're calling from Portland?
Portland, Oregon, yes.
Yes. So tell me about the street art in Portland.
Yeah, they do a lot of work here. It's, you know, I guess it's kind of stage one of the gentrification process. once the street art goes up, starts going up, your rent's going to be going up real soon. That's the downside of it, you know. But it sure is pretty, you know. One thing I do dislike is seeing like a blank wall, and it's when somebody does like a really pretty mural on it, you know, it's a nice thing. So one of the Irish pubs here, it's run by an Irish actor. He moved to America, started a bar, and he hired me to do like artwork on the side of his an alleyway that used to be a graffiti magnet, and it drove him nuts. So he put these three big blackboards up, and so I do all the artwork on them. So we're getting ready for a new round. I use markers. I don't use spray cans. I use markers, like oil-based marker pens. So I'll be out there for a few weeks drawing on these things.
Wow. I would love to see photos of everything that you create.
Oh, yeah, I'll definitely send some. Yeah, we try to document as much as we can because we've gone through so many of them. Like, I'll spend 2 weeks on one image, you know, so they're pretty elaborate. And, I'm doing it with hatch lines, so it has a very different look from more street art. But it's commercial in nature, so it's, you know. We don't tend to get noticed very much, but by the art people here. But you know, as I'm fond of like reminding people, I do have work in the Louvre. You know, I did have one of my images in my movie used it as a catalog illustration in the Louvre. But
hey.
Here's this guy doing all this work. Yeah, I get the boast about that. You know, but downhill all the way from here. You know, it's the only time I've ever been in the gallery. But yeah, no, they're great fun, and I get to not be hunched over a tablet, a drawing tablet, so I get to be standing up and leaning the other way. So maybe in another 30 years, I'll be slightly less hunched over.
You know, well, don't complain to me about being hunched over a tablet, because I know that you have a very nice Cintiq that you work on.
I have three of them now, a small mobile one. My sister moved back to America, to Ireland, so I went down to Burbank and took hers and packed it into a suitcase and brought it back here, so it's a spare in case this one dies. So yeah, you can't have enough. They're beautiful machines. They really are. But
you familiar with the brand XP Pen?
No.
Well, they're a low-rent, you know, sort of substitute for folks like me who can't really take the plunge on a Cintiq, which is a very pricey piece of kit. You know, it's a knockoff. I'll be drawing on it later today.
I'd love to try some of the knockoffs sometime, because I think, you know, the future will be the knockoffs will be dominant more than Cintiqs, because people can't afford them, you know. There's no way we can keep affording to spend $2,000 on a drawing screen.
You know, electronics companies send me cheap little gadgets to review. I put up a video yesterday where I was reviewing one. I would love to be in a position where people sent me, you know, the Cintiqs or a new iPad Pro or a Surface Pro or something like that. But that's probably asking for a lot for me, but not for you. You are a professional animator. And recently I saw an animated video that you did for a well-known musician whose name I can't bring to mind right now. Who was that?
Alan Parsons of the Alan Parsons Project.
Right.
And that was unreal. I was absolutely unreal. About a month before I got the job, my girlfriend and I went to see the movie Mandy with Nicolas Cage. And it was very violent and very stylish. And there's a bit in Mandy halfway through where they do like an animated cartoon inside the movie that's meant to have been done in the 1980s. And it really wasn't very convincing. It looked like it was done like 2 years ago, because it was. But they used the wrong tools for it, and as a result, it just didn't look like a period piece. And about a week afterwards, I said to her, "You know what I want? I want to have a project that's animation, about 30 seconds of animation inside a live-action project, like something like that thing in Mandy, where that'll people will know, and it'll be something popular." And you know, on and on I went, and it'll take me about 4 or 5 weeks to work on it. And then literally like a week after that, I got the email from the producer, you know, we're looking for an animator to work on this thing for Alan Parsons. And I wasn't that familiar with his music, but I was with his name and reputation. And my late wife, she was a huge fan of his. So if she was still alive, she'd be, you know, absolutely going wild. The deadline was pretty intense. We had 4 weeks to do about 40 seconds of fairly detailed animation. And it was just like round the clock, just working round the clock for 4 weeks. And about halfway through it, I got the email from the producer telling me, oh, by the way, Alan's going to be in Portland. Do you want to go see the concert? I'll get you tickets and you can meet him afterwards. So I did, and got to meet Alan's wife and the band. And it was really funny because one of the band members came up to me. Now, the place was packed. There was a lot of people there in the concert, about a couple of thousand people maybe. And he came up to me and said, you? And I said, what? And he said, we noticed you from the stage. And I said, why? And he said, well, everybody else was like waving backwards and forwards and clapping, and you were just standing there. They must have thought I looked like a gunman, you know. So I said, no. Aside from the fact that I'm a pretty stiff person anyway, you know, when you're working like, you know, without sleep for day after day, you don't want to move, you know. But no, it was fantastic, and I loved the song, and the end result was great, and it all turned out really well. I was actually able to add like about 3 extra scenes to it because we had a little bit of time left, and that was great when you can do that little bit of extra touches on it. And I wonder like what would have happened if they hadn't got me, you know, because there's not that many people who could have met that kind of deadline and gotten the look that they were looking for. And it was all animated, by the way, in Photoshop, so yeah. That was which I really enjoyed, the fact that I just did it in Photoshop and just like that gave it that hand drawn look. That was why that like
well, going it back was hand drawn.
Yeah. No, it was. there were no puppet systems in it. It was all done with like, you know, traditional animation methods for the most part. And that I think that really fit with that kind of Alan Parsons ethos, which is, you know, like the 80s and 90s kind of period that would be his glory years, you know.
Well, if folks are interested in seeing it, the song is As Light Falls. So just go to YouTube, type in Alan Parsons As Light Falls, and you will see and hear both, you know, new music from Alan Parsons and also animation from this week's guest, the Angry Animator, whose website is angryanimator.com, Dermot O'Connor. So you have been traveling quite a bit recently and spending some time down in sunny California. What's taking you down there?
I teach courses for LinkedIn Learning, formerly known as lynda.com. So I do these animation courses, and I've been down there just to do another little batch. And I think I can safely say we've just had the green light for another course, so there's more coming. And the new courses mostly deal with like traditional animation principles. So they'll deal with, you know, the fundamental principles of animation rather than like how to use this program or that program. And so that hopefully that will benefit like a much wider audience, and anybody who's working in any animation medium will be able to use these courses. I do a series called Tips and Tricks, and that's the batch that we did. And one episode goes up every week. And if I remember correctly, I think you can actually watch the weekly one as it goes up for free. Then it goes behind the paywall. But if you wanted to watch that, you wouldn't have to pay money. So you could see the latest one. So a person who knew that the weekly schedule could see that, could follow that whole course for no cost. And then I think there's a trial too, 10-day free trial. Doesn't cost anything either. So anyone who's on a tight budget can access a lot of the material without bankrupting themselves.
Well, as you well know, I'm very interested in the job implications of this switch to a completely digital and often, you know, completely automated economy. It's you know, there are challenges for young people trying to establish a career for themselves that didn't exist, you know, 20 years ago. And you are somebody who has weathered the storm, I would say, in an earlier transition. That was the transition from hand-drawn cell animation, which used to be, you know, industry standard, to various types of computer animation, you know, which allow one person to do the work of many. I mean, that's sort of the upshot of automation across the board. But just take a few minutes and talk about your journey, you know, going from somebody working with Don Bluth on animated films to somebody who is, you know, had to reinvent himself in middle age to find a new way to use your existing skill set to get on in the world.
Yeah, no, it was, I was probably one of the last people who could have begun you know, learning on the job on paper and pencil. And the transition, you could slowly see it coming. Like it would hit different departments at different times, but you would end up wondering, like, okay, where's this going to end? And one of the first, well, early in the 80, late 80s, you could see that they're starting to outsource a lot of the work to sweatshops in Asia. Cell painting went very early on, and then away went all the cell painting departments. And then it went digital, and then it went digital, and a lot, some of the work came back to America, but only to a smaller group of people. So the work came back from a lot of these Asian sweatshops to digital ink and paint studios in California. But again, you know, you're hiring 10% of the staff they used to have, because if you're painting on a computer, instead of painting with dipping into a paint pot, mixing paint, you're just clicking a button on a computer and filling an area. That's 20, 30 times quicker. So those jobs went away. A much smaller number came back. And that was going to, no matter what, how we protested, that was simply going to happen out of technology. And so you'd watch stuff like that and go, okay, at what point is this, or is this going to affect me? And then I think when I saw the first CGI animation that Pixar was doing, like Toy Story, when that came out, that was the first, you know, quote unquote, first animated feature. You kind of got the sense, okay, this is probably going to be everything. And it suits sooner or later. And by the late 90s, it was really obvious. DreamWorks began doing their own, and you could see fewer and fewer hand-drawn jobs coming down the road. And I, at the time in the mid-90s, I was working on computer games for Disney, and they were hand-drawn. We would actually draw them on paper and pencil, scan them in digitally and can paint them. But even then, you could just, even if you couldn't directly look at a graph, you just had this feeling. It was if you were paying attention, you could sense what was going to come. And by the early zeros, the whole traditional thing just imploded. It just came crashing in. And a friend of mine was, a few years ago, he was hired to direct the SpongeBob sequel, because he had directed or been like a top director or tech director on the first one. And it was one of the very few hand-drawn jobs that, you know, came along. And Marco said, oh, I told him that I had just been at the Animation Union building in Burbank. And he said, oh, I can't go there. I can't go there. And I said, why? And he said, oh, I get swamped. All these old people come up to me begging me for jobs. It's just so sad. And I'm like, oh, my God. It sounded terrible, you know. And you see all these people that were people older than me. Like, I'm 49. But there are people in their like mid to late 50s and 60s who couldn't make the jump. They were just maybe 5 years too old or whatever. And they didn't have the wherewithal to take on the learning curve of Flash animation or CGI or whatever. I leapt to Flash. When Flash came along in 99, when I got my hands on it, I jumped on it and I thought, this is going to be the future. And I was, and here's where we get into like the problem of predictions. It's really dangerous if you're right about what's going to happen, but you're wrong about when it's going to happen. And I was absolutely right that Flash is going to be the future in 1999. The problem was the jobs weren't going to arrive until 2004. And when you're living in 1999 and you've decided to make that jump, that's a really long wait. Yeah. And, you know, you can go really hungry during those. Like they, you know, you talk about it from this time and period, it's telescope, but that was 5 years. And there was a trickle of jobs began to come in, for me anyway, in 2003. And but by 2005, there was no problem. Then there were plenty of Flash jobs. And now it's moving on to Harmony, which is a very similar program, but it's more sophisticated. And of course, then there's the all the gazillions of CGI jobs, like all the 3D stuff that you see in, you know, like live action After Effects and animated movies. There are so many jobs for that. I don't know how those jobs could ever be automated, because I think you have to have a human brain at some point. Like, I know they can do things where they do like motion capture and they can, you know, do stuff. But even with that, there's only so far that gets you. You know, that's okay if you were going to make like a computer animated C-3PO. You know, you can put a man, that's basically a man in a suit. But I don't know how you can do that for, you know, like actually animated characters with different body proportions. You're always going to need a human brain, I think, to fine tune that and make it look good. So hopefully all those jobs at this point are safe. But then again, they're safe in the sense that, you know, humans can do them, but increasingly there's more studios now around the world too. So you are globally competing with people in India and the Middle East now is really starting to balloon. And I'm on LinkedIn site, and I get all these friend requests from people who find my courses. I would say the vast majority are from India and the Middle East, and I just approve them all. I'm like, okay, I don't know who you are, but you know, clearly you found me through the course, so I approve you. And hopefully they don't spam me, and they don't. I mean, it's just this wave of names from Asia. So I think the future will be still pretty difficult, even though there are human jobs. But I wonder what would happen if there's like a real downturn in the industry, and then we have an overtrained or an overinflated group of people who have this skill set, and then maybe half the number of jobs that used to exist. You know, a lot of people will fall out and not be able to survive in that kind of job market.
Yeah. I just listened to the audiobook of The War on Normal People. It's by Andrew Yang, who's running for president. He's the Silicon Valley candidate, and his big proposal is universal basic income. So I've just read the chapter and verse on how there are no safe jobs. I mean, yes, there are safe tasks. There are tasks that AI can't do right now. But if there's anything that is repetitive or routine that a corporation is paying humans to do, very shortly they will automate that. So, you know, departments will shrink. There will be a person who is necessary, you know, in the loop somewhere, but not nearly as many as there used to be.
Right. Yeah, my girlfriend's a teacher, and she was, well, sometime teacher. She moves between that and other jobs, but she said that she read a story about some school that tried to implement computer teachers, and they brought in these computers. They were, I forget what company was behind this thing, maybe Facebook or somebody. And they were trying to get the kids to be taught by a computer. And of course, the kids were melting down. they couldn't handle, you know, being taught by HAL 9000. I think you should take a stress pill, children. You know, I mean, at what point does the madness stop, you know?
The program
failed, and they went back to humans. But, you know, they'll try again. They'll go, oh, it was the algorithm wasn't good enough. That'll be their takeaway from that. It's just a way of trying to remove the human element. You know, in some respects, trying to save humans from dreary work is not a bad thing to do. I would prefer if humans didn't have to do horrible jobs and could do more interesting jobs. But the worst case scenario is humans doing no jobs. And that's really politically dangerous as well, because, you know, the devil finding work for idle hands as well. People need to have some other thing. You don't just pull out, you know, one thing and give them nothing, no matter how bad that one thing is. Like the same way that Thatcher destroyed the mines in the north of England and, you know, throughout Wales and whatever. She, you know, I don't want people going down mines, but at the same, what I want even less is the entire mining community is destroyed by police baton charges and then those men thrown on the dole. That's even worse. So if you're going to do that, you have to put something better in place. I'm just worried that the UBI solves the brute physical nature of, you know, the human element. You know, okay, they have enough money to eat, and that's good. But if you don't give people purpose, or you don't give people like some meaning in their lives or some task, then you're going to have problems. And I wonder too that UBI might be a bait and switch. Like, we'll give you UBI, but we'll take away these other social programs as well. And there might be like something behind it that's not benign. But I think, you know, in general outline, I do believe in UBI, but not if it's going to be like a cover for something potentially dark.
So again, regular listeners to the podcast will know that UBI stands for Universal Basic Income, but people listening on the radio might not be as quick with that acronym. So the idea is that rather than, well, there's two different versions of UBI. There's sort of the left-wing version and the right-wing version. The left-wing version is just send everybody some money in addition to all the social welfare programs that are in place right now. And the right-wing version is scrap all the existing programs and just send everybody, you know, a monthly check. And that is going to take money away from, you know, targeted programs to give it to a really indiscriminate, untargeted program. Because a lot of the people that you'll be giving this money to don't need it. So I've heard Andrew Yang pitch the benefit of UBI. One of the benefits is being that administrative costs are much lower than the current system. And that's only true if you scrap the current system in favor of just sending everybody a monthly check. So kind of sounds like he's pitching the libertarian version of UBI, which is not surprising, given that, you know, he represents Silicon Valley and they tend to be pretty pretty libertarian in Silicon Valley with, you know, just a sort of patina of social justice concerns sprinkled on top to distract people from the fact that, you know, they're to the right of most Republicans.
Yeah, I've seen so many of these like political ideas over the years, and they always seem to have like a sting in the tail.
They have a what?
A sting in the tail. Like, oh, okay, yes. That sounded good on paper, and then you see what happens. Like, yeah, that wasn't really what we were being given, was it?
Yeah. Yeah, my major concern with universal basic income is that there is already in place in our society a layer of the economy just devoted to extracting money from poor people. And, you know, just giving everybody money, well, that sector of the economy is going to go crazy. I mean, the poor people are going to have lots of money to spend, and they're rather easy to seduce into debt slavery and debt traps. So I could well imagine that the people who most need that universal basic income will be the people who never see it because somebody else, some creditor, has a claim on it.
Yeah, I think, it'll have, unintended consequences or intended consequences.
I think it would be intended and easily anticipated in that case. I mean, anybody who advances UBI and does not address that concern, to me, is not playing in good faith.
I wonder if they've modeled, like, potential social breakdown scenarios and found that, you know, given a certain degree, at a critical threshold of mass unemployment, you get riots. And that maybe this is, like, a way to just keep people, stopped with alcohol, you know, or whatever other computer games or whatever it is that's going to stop them from breaking up the streets and going all yellow jacket on us.
Or yellow vest is how it gets reported here in the, you know, in the mainstream media in the States. In the book, Andrew Yang says, look, all my Silicon Valley peers, they are all very well-intentioned people. They have nothing but love in their hearts for humanity. But they're also buying doomsteads in Alaska and New Zealand, and, you know, they have a plane on standby ready to flee as soon as everything goes to hell. So the Silicon Valley folks have surely run those simulations that you're talking about social disruption, and the results prompt them to buy real estate in far-flung locales.
Right. Yeah. They're a strange bunch of people.
Well, what else is on your mind these days? If you can believe it, we're halfway through almost.
No, I've been having great fun following just the ongoing meltdown, like Brexit and all the stuff going on in Britain is like nothing I've ever seen. To watch the Brexit party launched by Nigel Farage only three or four months ago is now the second biggest party in Britain. They might even surpass the Tories at the next election on a good day or a bad day, depending on your point of view. And as somebody pointed out, the Brexit party isn't really a political party. It's more like a private company. So whatever people think about the pros and cons of Donald Trump, the situation in Britain right now is even stranger because you have a man who could conceivably be prime minister under the British system. It's not maybe likely, but it's possible. And he is the leader of essentially a private company, not a political party. You can't join the Brexit party. You can't vote in the Brexit party. It's basically Nigel Farage. That's it. So talk about like a threat to liberal democracy. One writer pointed out that this kind of political organization last existed in the early 1800s. So all these people have been running around worrying about a return to the 1930s. And instead what you have is a return to the 1830s. So getting back to an old theme of mine, it's like if people weren't getting so caught up comparing all their enemies to Adolf Hitler, then they might realize that actually it's more like one of the early 19th century rotten boroughs in the UK that seems to be trying to resurrect itself. And on the other side of the political aisle, there's Change UK, which is an ostensibly social democratic party, pro-Remain, and they're also a cadre party. They're also, you know, you can't join. It's basically set up as a private company. So we have two of these things now on each side of the political so-called spectrum, and they're both organized in this very reactionary, very, old model because they don't trust the people. They've given up hope on, maybe Farage is very good reason because the kind of people who support him tend to be really scary, many of them. Not all of them, but a sufficient number to wreck his plans. And the guys on the social democratic side are probably afraid of entryism, you know, people coming in who are further to their left and then trying to take, you know, to drive it in a way that they don't want. So this complete distrust of the electorate is not a very liberal policy, I think, because liberalism was, you know, at least in the 19th century, as it played out, was it more of like a, you know, populist or a mass movement that was expanding freedom to a greater number of people, not contracting it? So it's a very weird phenomenon. And of course, then now they're going into a new prime minister who will have the same insoluble Gordian knot. So the entire British system now, both major parties are under incredible stress and pressures and almost fracturing, and the Conservatives more so. So it would be, I've always wondered what would it look like to see a major political party just crack in two. So we might find out very soon.
Indeed. Indeed. You know, you say some folks are focused on the 1930s, and there are certain folks on the left. There's a layer of them who call everybody who disagrees with them a Nazi, and they don't yep. seem to be using the term metaphorically or evocatively. I mean, they just seem to be flat-footed in their belief that, you know, the Fourth Reich is here, and that everybody who is at all to the right of, you know, the people who are furthest left is, in fact, a secret Nazi with, you know, swastika armbands, you know, ready to be slipped on as soon as it's at all, you know, feasible. And you say that really we should be thinking back to the 1830s. And I'd like to ask you to just talk about what the economic, technological, and political landscape looked like in the 1830s.
Well, I wouldn't be much of an expert on that, but, you know, you had the enclosures, you had, you know, the privatization of everything. It was like a major, you know, people land clearances where peasants are kicked off their own land. And I mean, it's a horrendous time for if you weren't wealthy. And, you know, you don't have to invoke the specter of the Reich to be very critical of the current political paradigms. And I think that was the problem. I know we spoke in 2016 when Trump was elected. I saw my Facebook feed light up with Kristallnacht memes, and I thought, people are losing their minds. I mean, I can't speak so much about the 1830s, but it's good to have at least like a crude idea of some ideas about what fascism might be, what it looked like. And as a quick rule of thumb, I mean, as John Michael Greer pointed out, the word could be translated roughly into groupism. You know, it's a collectivist ideology. And so if you have a group of people who are radically individualistic and becoming more so, you know, and who cover that with a gloss of patriotism, that doesn't make you a very good building block for fascism. And any good fascist movement would probably not want these people in it, because part of the appeal of fascism is you surrender a good chunk of your individual rights to the group. I don't see anybody doing that. You know, I don't see anybody queuing to give up their precious individual rights, quote unquote, which is a very liberal idea. You know, the system of rights, and then I want to give up my rights to, you know, the party leader. No one's doing it, and you know, they're selling people more individualism. So whatever this thing is, it could have elements that are very fascistic, but, you know, it's any belief system is going to have, you know, elements from another. You know, the fascists themselves borrowed stuff from socialism to appeal to socialists so that they could poach enough of them to get into power. It doesn't make them socialists. And it's just kind of lazy use of language that it's very wearying if you're trying to have like a conversation about this stuff that's beyond just like snarl words. Which is what most of these people are doing. They're just using a semantic snarl. Grr, I hate you. That's when they said Nazi. I mean, they've hypnotized themselves into thinking that they're being, you know, fighting for good against evil. But if you're calling somebody something that they're not, even if they share some characteristics of that person, you know, that's getting you nowhere. And it's like it's the old know your enemy and know yourself. And they don't even know themselves too, as it turns out.
Are you on Twitter?
God, no.
Okay, you are the healthier for it. I am on Twitter. And somebody I was following posted, he basically just asserted that this guy named Styx Hexenhammer 666, a fellow Vermonter and daily YouTube uploader, is a Nazi. And, you know, I followed Styx Hexenhammer for several months. I listened to his videos, you know, day in and day out. Clearly not a Nazi. I mean, there's no way that you could assert that he's a Nazi with any sort of credibility. And so I responded to the tweet, and this was ill-advised, but I said, you know, I listened to this guy every day for several months. I see no indication that he's a Nazi. And if you accuse him of being a Nazi, you know, you're either coming from a place of dishonesty or complete ignorance. And this person responded to me saying only this: he's a Nazi. So I just roll my eyes. And I unfollowed the guy. You know, I thought, oh, that's great. I won't have to deal with this person anymore. And yet I'm getting notification after notification after notification that people have liked his assertion. He's a Nazi.
God. It's exhausting.
It is. Yeah. So... I've blown past the bottom of the hour. I should say that you are listening to Sea Realm Radio on WOOL 91.5 FM in Bellows Falls, Vermont. I am your host, KMO. I am speaking to Dermot O'Connor, the angry animator, and the person I know who... there's two people I know who read a lot of real books still. Unfortunately, I'm not one of them. But you and Jim... your ad attacker, the podcaster behind Attack Ads. Do you listen to the Attack Ads podcast?
I don't, no.
Oh, it's amazing. It's really excellent. And there's an exclamation point in it. Attack Ads is a command. You know, it's an imperative.
Okay. All right.
He lives in Seattle. I, you know, as with you, I have met him face-to-face in person probably right about the same time. I was there in 2010 with Neil Kramer. I think I met you in 2013, didn't I?
Yeah, something like that.
Still, 2010, 2013, pretty close together in my mind now, in 2019.
Yeah.
So tell me, what do you hear from the students who are taking your course, you know, in terms of, you know, what they think their career prospects are, or what, you know, how the information that they're getting from you is going to serve them in earning a living?
I don't actually get too much direct feedback, but I tell you one thing I have noticed though, like it's on the, you know, LinkedIn has like a feed now. It's like Facebook. And when it began, I thought, oh, this is great. You know, everyone here is here just talking about work, and you know, it's really fun, and there's no negativity or toxic swill or any of that horrible stuff. And you know where this is going. So, then LinkedIn bought Lynda, and so I ended up being, you know, effectively a de facto LinkedIn employee, I guess. And then Microsoft bought LinkedIn, so now technically I'm a Microsoft employee. I didn't sign up for this, but I love Microsoft now. So the LinkedIn feed. So LinkedIn bought Lynda for the small sum of $1.5 billion with a B. And I thought, when you spend $1.5 billion with a B, I think it's fair to expect a company to get value from that. So they began promoting all of our LinkedIn, our Lynda or LinkedIn Learning courses, as it's called now, on the feed. And I would see fairly aggressively, to be fair, you know, they did push them pretty hard. And some of my courses would go up and other authors' courses would go up. And initially you'd see the comments and it was all like, oh, this is great, very useful. Then after about a few weeks, a certain small minority of people began to get annoyed by them, and they began to post some really toxic comments after these courses, like personal attacks on the course authors. And I thought, you know, here we go. You know, this is why we can't have nice things, because it just takes a small number of people to not understand, you know, you not understand. I understand the frustration of your feed, which you don't pay for, by the way. You know, it's a free service that you can use. And you don't like the ads on it, but these are owned by LinkedIn Learning. And if this company is to stay here as a going concern, they have to make a profit. And that doesn't involve giving away everything for free forever. So, and there was one guy with his username had a PhD after it. And he began doing these personal attacks on course authors. And he would post about how, you know, he was his last recourse was to insult the course authors. And I couldn't resist anymore. I said to him, I type, do you not understand the relationship of, as I'm an author, do you not understand our relationship with the company? That we're just employees. That'd be like you going into a McDonald's and finding the manager of a McDonald's and saying, you know, I'm shocked at the quality of the food in this establishment. You should do something about it. You know, that's what you're doing. And this guy had a PhD after his name. So what that tells you about PhD programs, I'm not sure, but nothing good. But so I don't read those comments anymore. I see my course going up and I don't read the comments. I know that they'll be 95% good, but I don't want to read the 5% poison. So, and it makes me very shy of interacting with students because, you know, again, I don't want to deal with the hassle factor. So I know that the overwhelming feedback that I have been given by my producers at LinkedIn is good, or they wouldn't keep hiring me. And we put a lot of work into them. I'm very proud of them. I was down in Los Angeles, I met a guy who did an online training course for Don Bluth. And I don't think I'm giving away any secrets, but he cost him $10,000. It won't cost you $10,000 to do my courses. And I'm going to be quite bold now. My courses are better than you'll learn more from my courses than you would from Don. I learned under Don, but he's a brilliant animator. He's probably the best or one of the top three or four animators who'll ever live. That doesn't make you a good teacher. And, you know, it's a different skill set. And this guy actually had to, like, bail on the course because it wasn't working for him. Because it wasn't structured in the right way to, like, train people. So you're welcome to spend $10,000 if you like, but wouldn't be my advice. You can either get mine for free or you can pay the $50 a year or whatever it is for your choice. You get a bank loan if you want or just reach into your pocket. You know, it's all the same to me. But, yeah, it's I feel bad for students who get an education that could be done so much more easily. You know, if you know how to communicate the material, you can break down very complicated subject matter and structure it. You can see, if anyone wants to see my teaching style, if you go on my YouTube channel or just go on YouTube and do a search for the 21 Foundations of Animation. That's basically my big sales pitch for the new course that I'm doing. And all the slides in that will actually be material from my previous Lynda/LinkedIn courses. So it basically shows you, if you watch that, you'll then see the entire nuts and bolts of how to animate in 9 minutes. And there's about 3 years worth of animation work gone into that. So that'll fly by you in 9 minutes. And I think it's crisp. I think it's clear, you know, and it's structured logically, which is more than I can say for a lot of the animation textbooks out there.
Well, what I like about what you teach is that it is not specific to any, particular software package or anything like that. And the information that you impart, you know, if the students actually learn it, it will serve them regardless of what tools they're using to create animated, you know, animated film, animated movies, animated videos. I'm not sure, you know, what other word I can put behind animated, but what you're teaching is animation. It is not, you know, you're not teaching just how to plug something into an existing structure that does the work for you.
Right. I've even structured the 21 foundations to in such a way that if a person were just to do, say, storyboards or comic books, I've even layered it so that the higher principles would apply to that kind of material. So if you were dancing, if you were an actor, if you were doing pantomime, the first 7 or 8 principles don't directly apply to, you know, pure animation. They are also applicable to, like, live action theater or other things too, like how to stage a scene, how to block a scene, that kind of thing. So when you see some of the other books, the way they're laid out, there's no logical order to them. You know, some of them put the difficult stuff at the beginning. It's incomprehensible how anyone would do that. You know, and even the old Disney guys and Frank and Ollie, when they did their book, completely disordered. Like they made a list of 12 principles and I've got 21. And theirs just doesn't work. All these kids are out there like reading this 12 principles of animation nonsense, and it is. It's just nonsense. It's almost double that, you know. And so, if you get off on the wrong foot like that, you know, that can have consequences because then you're like stumbling around in the dark trying to figure out, you know, why are my scenes not quite working, and. You know, I would find out during the years, oh, yeah, there's this other thing that Frank and Ollie never mentioned. Oh, there's this other thing that they never mentioned. And then you realize there's an awful lot they didn't mention in that book. I wish I'd known that when I was 21. And so this was a way of piecing that together. My whole thing is my imaginary reader is me when I was 21. There you go. This will save you 10 years beating your head off the wall. And so hopefully I think the students get it. They may not know it, but I think they're getting that. They may not know how much they're getting, but they are.
I would love to be, you know, housed in my 21-year-old body again, but I sure wouldn't want to be 21 years old in 2019. It just,
no.
The future seems really precarious, particularly for somebody trying to create a career and, you know, find a way to earn a living.
Oh, and having all of the stuff that you wrote on the internet saved forever, you know?
Oh, man.
Like the stupid stuff that I wrote was in notebooks or conversations in real life. No one remembers it. It's all lost, thank God. And all these kids are just writing and tapping and typing and typing, and it's all on a database. And I, you know, God, terrible.
Well, I think some of them anyway, have figured out that that's a danger, because my 18-year-old son is a he's an online ghost. You cannot find any hint that he actually exists, you know, unless you know, unless you're part of his peer group and you're in that secret Discord server that he spends all his time on. But
I saw an article recently that described it as the dark forest. And it said when you go into a forest at night, all the animals that usually would make noise are really quiet because they're trying not to get killed by owls. And it said that's what, and the writer said, that's what I am on the internet now. I'm so afraid to make any noise. And in the article, I think the thing was, okay, I'm afraid of the guys on the right side, but I'm really scared of the ones on the liberal side, because they're the ones that will just lynch you. You know, they're the ones that will just lynch you. You know, they will get you. They will, you know, come for you if you use one wrong word, and then you're done for. And so he removed, even though he himself is fairly center left, he just like doesn't speak anymore online. And that's very much the way I am too. I mean, this conversation notwithstanding, I don't like typing my opinions into the internet anymore. So I disappear from the pitch. And I would be a very good person to have on a political team, but I don't dare do it now. Because I like to have, I have a serious medical condition where if I don't eat food, I starve to death and die. And,
I have that same condition.
I don't want to die, you know, and these people would happily take away my livelihood if I used one of the bad words. Now, regardless of the context, and they're always looking for, this is what frightens me, they're always looking for new vectors of outrage. It's what Angela Nagel calls creating scarcity in an economy of virtue. You know, the virtue is the currency. For the currency to have value, it has to be limited. So we're trying to make it harder and harder to be a good person. And that's what it feels like. So 5 years from now or 10 years from now, some innocent word that we've just used could be one of the bad words that means you're a Nazi. And then somebody will find that on a computer website and they'll pull it out and then they'll get you. You know, but this person said that 10 years ago and nobody batted an eye. But 10 years later, it's an existential threat to Western civilization and that person has to be destroyed. So what sane person would be on Twitter these days posting anything, you know? And so I post, you know, just personal stuff now, and I'm very careful about what I write. And I have to be very careful, even with the animation stuff, that I don't try to step on any culture bombs. You know, and I'm kind of worried about some of the stuff that I do, because some of the stuff that I do does deal with history, and it does deal with material that people might choose to be outraged by, even though the fundamental message is very egalitarian and very tolerant and all the rest of it. But you're never good enough for there's certain swathe of people that you're never good enough for, because they have to prove how good they are. And they have to prove how good they are by destroying Nazis.
And finding Nazis, you know, when they don't exist.
Yeah, yeah. I wish there was a catchy name for, like, the Red Scare, but it's like that. Yeah, it's a hysteria.
You know, As I mentioned, I've listened to Andrew Yang's book, The War on Normal People. And in it, he speaks very highly of Yuval Noah Harari, who wrote books like Sapiens and Homo Deus, and most recently, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. And in 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, Yuval Noah Harari has nothing good to say, really, about the idea of universal basic income. He says that it is a painkiller. It you know, numbs the pain of the people who are living without purpose and with inadequate material supply, and it also it soothes the stinging conscience of the people who are doing really, really well in this economic transition. You know, people who are making billions of dollars and buying their doomsday retreats in New Zealand. That UBI for them is also a numbing agent. It numbs their sense that they don't really deserve to be as fabulously wealthy as they are.
Right. Yeah. There's a joke I found on a socialist website a while ago, and it was a liberal says that the richest 8 people in America have more money than the poorest 50%. And oh, I got it wrong. A socialist says the 8 richest people have more money than the poorest 50%. And the liberal replies, that's an outrage. 4 of those people should be women of color.
Yeah.
So, you know, turning that seems to be the fixation. You know, it's this lens of the individual, of let's just look at each individual actor, and if we just have like a correct distribution of all of our identity groups across the capitalist system, all will be well. And it's not. The problem is a capitalist system that grows exponentially or collapses. I mean, that's the problem. And anybody who thinks you can fix that by bolting on, like, you know, a more equal distribution among the social groups, or by bolting a solar panel or a windmill on top of it, is deluding themselves. You know, the problem is systemic. And it's this perpetual focus on individuals, the bad guys, individual good guys, completely misses the point. And I know that looking at systems is very difficult, and people seem to be like allergic to doing it. But that's the fundamental difference between somebody coming from like a material left socialist background and a liberal background. These are very different ideologies. And I think there's like a delusion or a confusion on the American right circuit. Liberals and socialists are all the same. They're all over there, and one will turn into the other. It's like, no, these are two different ideologies. And they're, you know, you have to like make a big leap to go from being a liberal to being a socialist. And whether you like liberals or socialists or not is irrelevant. But, you know, again, socialism is a collectivist. It looks at class. It looks at groups of people, not like, doesn't reduce history into like, let's look at all these individual people acting in their own interest. That's an 18th century idea that is just not going to work for us if we want to see why things are happening. And so that's one reason why I don't want to type too much online. Okay, we're talking into an MP3 file, I guess, but they're harder to mess with. It's not going into like a database of black and white that can be cut and paste quite right. So easily.
You know, I was listening to Yuval Noah Harari's book, Homo Deus, as I walked over here to the radio station. And something that I heard just before I came in the door and had to take the earbuds out was that if Karl Marx were alive today, he would tell his followers, spend less of your time and effort and energy reading Das Kapital and spend more time learning how the internet works and studying the human genome. And I don't think that would go over very well with many contemporary Marxists.
No, I doubt it. I think I've read other Marxists, and they've said, look, you know, these people who said that the old Marxist idea of the proletariat is void are completely wrong. There's never been a bigger proletariat. You know, the proletariat's the biggest it's ever been, and all the things that he said in the 19th century still stand about the analysis, the internal contradictions of capitalism. They're all still there. You know, he would not have recognized Russia or China as candidates for revolution in any respect. You know, Terry Eagleton wrote a book called Why Marx Was Right. And it's worth reading, again, whether you like Marx or not. And I wouldn't call myself a Marxist per se, but it's interesting to know what this philosopher thought. And, you know, he felt, you know, there had to be, capitalism had to exist for a very long time to build the wealth before it could be redistributed, so that you could certainly not have in any sense have anything resembling Marxism emerge from peasant Russia or peasant China. You had to have a very wealthy country to have a revolution first. And that meant a lot of capitalism. And he was all for capitalism, not as an end of itself, but as a means to an end. And however long that was going to go on for, that's a different question. A little vague on that. But we certainly have, if you look at the system we have now, there's no reason why there's a plenitude. We have more than enough for everybody. It's about the distribution. And there's no reason why anybody has to be a designated loser. You know, there is plenty. Oh, here's a story. So the Irish homeless problem, we have a homeless problem, which is kind of, compared to San Francisco, we don't have a homeless problem, but in relative to Ireland, we do. Somebody worked out that for all the charities, homeless charities that are given money, they calculated the amount of money given to each homeless charity and then how that corresponded to the number of homeless people. Per homeless person, the charities get something like 50,000 euro. So they could just give the 50,000 euro to each homeless person. I mean, you get the meaning. I mean, there's plenty of money. There's plenty of stuff. There's no reason why anybody has to be homeless. It's a distribution problem. It's a social problem. It's not a shortage of material. And that would be a more Marxist way of looking at it. You know, but they want to make it about the individual defects of these homeless people or whatever. And I don't know how they have been driven into their tents and their alleys, but I suspect a lot of it's because of systemic issues in the society that we live in.
I don't hold any euros, and I don't really have any reason to know day to day what one is worth. But I just looked it up. So a euro is worth $1.12 right now. So 50,000 euros is a middle class salary, and
yeah. But we give that middle class salary to the middle class people who run the charities. And they're probably somebody in that charity is making CEO money.
Yep.
Because that 50 grand isn't hitting the street. That 50 grand is going somewhere else. Now, some of it's hitting the street, but nowhere near 50, nowhere near 100%. There's no way. And whenever I always tell people, like, whenever a politician says there's no money, they're performing a mental reservation. They're saying half the sentence. What they mean is there's no money for you.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of stuff. There's plenty of money. There's never a shortage of money. It's just, you know, you're not getting it.
Yep. Absolutely. You know, this a few years ago, one of your hot button issues was tech people moving to Portland, putting up ugly buildings, driving up rents, that sort of thing. You haven't mentioned it in this conversation. Have you moved on? I'm guessing from the noises you're making, no, you haven't.
No, they knocked down a house across the street and they put up, I call them Borg cubes. They put up a Borg cube. I should send you a photograph. It's just awful. It's ghastly. Oh, and the thing too, they're so tall. They have these really long, thin drain pipes. And when it rains, when you walk by, what you hear is ding, 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 ding from the rain, like impacting the ground. It would drive me out of my mind if I had to listen to that every time it rained. And it rains here often enough. You know? And this thing across the street, it's just, it's hideous. This beautiful old building, you know, it was all fallen down and everything, but it was still aesthetically pleasing, and there was a nice garden. Garden's gone. The whole thing was concrete with a Borg cube. So, you know, then they'll wonder. The people who will move in, no doubt, will be complaining about how there's so few insects and birds and bees around. Well, yeah, it's because of your house, basically, you know. And you left nothing. You left nothing. There's like, I think there's like 10 square feet of grass in front of it. And the building codes here have just gotten worse over time. And they're about size. It's brutalism.
Now, Portland has urban growth boundaries, right?
Yeah, they have. Like, they didn't want to go beyond a certain point. So I don't know to what extent they've been playing with that. But the whole ethos about these was density. Let's have density. But if you look at these big gigantic houses, they're not. They're big rooms. We have actually one that's like two houses up from us. And when we walk, now it's gone through in 7 years like its fourth occupant. And when you walk past it, the windows are out open, and it's one big room. And the original craftsman that it replaced, it was a quarter of the size, would have had seven or eight small rooms. But this thing has just one big room. So you can't put communal living in there. You can't put, you know, roommates in there. They would kill each other. And so that's, I think a lot of these houses are like that, big, gigantic rooms. Here's the rec room. Here's the dad's room, you know, and all this rubbish. And, yeah, I don't see how, like, a group of people could happily live together in there. So it's sad. It's they're making it less dense, not more dense, but they're making the houses bigger so that they can pretend that they're apartments.
Well, we're down to just about 3.5 minutes. I'd like to invite you to talk about your podcast and tell people where they can access that.
Oh, the podcast that I'm working on right now is with my girlfriend. It's called bloomsandbarnacles.com, and it's a James Joyce podcast. So she does the blog, she takes the lead on the podcast as well. I do the illustrations, and we talk about anything relating to Ulysses and James Joyce, which has led down some very interesting rabbit holes, including Renaissance magic, hence the Francis Gates at the beginning.
Yeah, which we never got around to talking about.
Oh, that's a whole subject for itself. Yeah, that's huge. Very interesting stuff, though. But no, I've never read Ulysses. But I probably feel like I have now because I've read all of her posts and she's always talking about it. So, it's a very difficult book, definitely, but there's parts of it that aren't, that are very accessible. So her whole approach is to be non-academic about it. It's a non-academic approach to Ulysses to try to make it accessible to people and take some of the mystery off of it.
Well, I have not read Ulysses either, and I've spent some time staring at pages in, Finnegan's Wake, but not even getting below the surface.
Yeah, Carl Jung met Joyce and he diagnosed him. He said that Joyce was a schizophrenic under will. And he said that basically he is a schizophrenic, but he has sufficient mental powers that he's able to control it. And of course, Joyce's daughter was a schizophrenic. She had a full-blown psychosis. And Joyce tried to convince Jung that, you know, she was like him. And Jung said, no, you're diving, she's drowning. So, but yeah, Finnegan's Wake is like a word salad. There may be a point to it, but it's any given page, just try to read a paragraph, and it's horrifying. Ulysses, though, has more of a narrative thread through it, and it has passages that do that, but then it goes back to the day in Dublin.
All righty. Well, final thoughts. We're down to about a minute and a half.
Oh, God. Just keep watching Brexit. Great fun. I think I every day I run out of the British newspapers and I'm like, what's happened now? Are they still there? And it's just, I know some people are freaking out about it, but I just look at it as a theater at this point.
Well, that's probably a good way to go about it if you want to preserve your own sanity and peace of mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm kind of resolving to take the 2020 presidential election in just that spirit.
Don't nobody lose their mind over it. Don't fall out with friends. Don't post about it on the social media. Don't share memes. Just walk away. Go for a walk.
Yes.
Have a coffee. Find a coffee shop. Have a coffee and a scone or something. That's it.
All right. I kind of put Dermot on the spot early on in the conversation when I asked him to describe the political and the economic and social setting of the 1830s. It's not something I could answer right off the top of my head, but I did go to Wikipedia and look around a little bit. In fact, in the Wikipedia entry for the 1830s, and there is one, and it's long because it covers basically the whole world, there's a map of the United States from 1837, and in it, the westernmost states are Missouri, Arkansas, and Louisiana. Arkansas and Louisiana both being contiguous with the independent nation, the Republic of Texas. And all of those three states, Missouri, Arkansas, and Louisiana, were slave states. And in fact, there is an unnamed territory just west of Arkansas. It's in the shape and position of current-day Oklahoma, and it was a slave territory. So in 1837, slave states and free states were balanced. There were 13 of each. The Irish potato famine was still a decade and a half in the future. The French Revolution took place in 1830. So that gives you an idea of the world of 1830. Did you ever see the Steven Spielberg historical film Amistad about the slaves who were put on trial for murdering the crew of a ship that they were being transported on? That incident took place on July 1st, 1839. So if you remember the imagery from that film, that's from the late 1830s. Obviously, it's all contemporary, but it was meant to look as though it was from the 1830s. Also, the Siege of the Alamo started in 1836. Also, from that Wikipedia page, the 1830s for Mexico saw the end of the First Mexican Republic and saw General Santa Anna move in and out of the presidency in a 30-year span, now known as the Age of Santa Anna. In science, in 1839, the first parallax measurement of the distance to Alpha Centauri is published by Thomas Henderson. Samuel Morse patented the telegraph in 1837. And in 1834, Charles Babbage begins the conceptual design of an analytical engine, a mechanical forerunner of the modern computer. It will not be built in his lifetime. And in 1834, Thomas Davenport, the inventor of the first American DC electrical motor, installs his motor in a small model car, creating one of the first electric cars. In other parts of the world, the 1830s saw a widespread pandemic of cholera. The top of the page reads, the 1830s decade ran from January 1st, 1830 to December 31st, 1839. In this decade, the world saw a rapid rise of imperialism and colonialism, particularly in Asia and Africa. Britain saw a surge of power and world dominance as Queen Victoria took the throne in 1837. Conquests took place all over the world, particularly around the expansion of Ottoman Empire and the British Raj. New outposts and settlements flourished in Oceania as Europeans began to settle over Australia and New Zealand. As for the population of the Earth at that time, it's estimated that the global population topped 1 billion around 1804, plus or minus 10 years. So by the 1830s, the total population of the world was probably around 1.1 billion. You know, approximately. A lot of people have entered the scene, and a lot of people have left the scene since then, though in recent years, a lot more people have entered than have left. Thus, our current global population somewhere between 7 and 8 billion, I think. There's a website called worldometers.info, and there's a section of it called World Population Clock. And right now, and it's an ever-shifting number, it will be different by the time I get to the end of this number, the current world population is 7,707,093,973,458,85. I mean, it's growing fast. So far, live births today, 254,100, and it's, you know, all the way past, it's into the 120s by now. And deaths today, 106,630-something. So births this year. Right now, the number is 56,926,930. You know, it's already out of the 30s by now, but, you know. And total deaths for the year, 23,884,700. And then the number there is moving too fast for me to really pin down. So more than twice as many people have been born than have died this year. It's a strange sight to watch. Just watch all of these numbers. Just, I'd say creep up, but some of them are doing more than creeping. So I'm going to be talking, I'm going to have a couple different conversations on the topic of population, population pressure, bringing population under control, topics of that nature. It's strange. I mean, I remember when I was in college and I would get very irritated when people would tell me that, you know, there was no such thing as overpopulation or the population wasn't a problem. And I would just, you know, do some very basic math for them, you know, with regard to daily calorie intake per capita and how, you know, every time you double the population, you have to double the food supply. And that was decades ago. And since then, the only famines that I know about in this world have been the result of war or gross political mismanagement. But absolute constraints on agricultural land or the ability to produce crops on it has not produced a famine yet. So the first of those conversations will be with Bill Ryerson. He is the director of the Population Media Center, which is located right here in Vermont. I met him in Dallas, Texas a few weeks back. And he is a very busy guy. He does a lot of traveling. He said he spends about 40% of his time on the road. But I've got him booked as a guest on the radio show for the 16th of June. But what I was saying with you know, reflections on my college days, decades back now, and issues around population, I'm less concerned about population now than I was then. I'm less concerned about so many things. I'm less concerned about nuclear war. I can't say I'm less concerned about climate change. But I am less concerned about population than I have been in a very long time. And it could just be that, you know, as a young man, a lot of my concerns were hypothetical and theoretical. And now, as a middle-aged man, my concerns are more practical. My concern horizon is probably smaller. It's mostly focused on me and my local community and my kids. You know, it's an item of common folk wisdom that people, particularly men, get more conservative as they get older. And I wonder if just contracting concern horizons either equals or gets mistaken for political conservatism, or maybe makes one susceptible to political conservatism. I'm definitely not advancing any pet theory on that question. I'm just putting the question out there. All right, I'm going to wrap this up, get this thing uploaded for you, because I do need to go shoot video at a municipal meeting tonight, because I do live in New England, and boy, we are politically engaged here. I will talk to you again quite soon. Stay well.